Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Colette Bennett. The current crisis surrounding COVID-19, the coronavirus, has highlighted the weaknesses in both Ireland's social and economic structures. One such area is housing, particularly for those in communal and cramped accommodation who cannot social distance, self-isolate, or in some cases even avail of adequate washing facilities. To discuss this and other issues, I was joined remotely by Orla Hegarty, architect and lecturer in the School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy in UCD.
So Orla, thank you very, very much for joining me today. I hope you're safe and well.
I am, thank you.
Great. So straight into it, I suppose. You've been engaged in the area of housing policy for quite some time now, particularly for Ireland's housing needs. What would you have seen as the key challenges in terms of housing prior to the current crisis that we're in?
I think prior to the current crisis, and we might talk about how much everything has changed in the last few weeks, prior to the current situation, I felt the two main challenges were affordability and capacity to build housing, or capacity in the construction industry. And what I meant by affordability is a lot of people were housed, but housed in such a way that it was impacting on the rest of their lives. So they were paying far too much for their housing, which was limiting them doing other things, or they couldn't afford to move, so they couldn't take up a job somewhere else, or they couldn't have space for another child, or they couldn't, do a lot of things they wanted to do because where they were living was too small or too far away, or they were commuting long distances, or they were sharing with too many people. So aside from the very sharp end of the housing crisis, where we saw the number of homeless people and the number of people in really poor temporary accommodation, there's a lot more pain out there in housing distress, and a lot of it was going back to affordability, that people were very compromised because of the cost of housing. So I felt that affordability was kind of at the root of all aspects of it. And then the second aspect was to do with just the capacity to turn the situation around. We were coming out of a very deep recession that affected construction very, very badly, and impacted on skills and everything else in that sector. And that there wasn't a structured approach to rebuilding capacity or to helping people get back into that sector. So we had very low capacity and very high prices, which obviously suited a number of players very well, but didn't really suit the housing system. So that's where we were at. And I didn't feel that increasing supply, which was the sort of government target, was going to address either of those problems. Because trying to increase supply when you've limited capacity was just going to mean we had more houses built badly, and the prices would go up, and that would impact then on affordability and would worsen the affordability problem. So we were sort of caught in a circular loop on chasing supply, chasing developer viability, which was just adding cost every year on year. We were seeing, you know, prices going from 250 average, 300, and then 350,000 average last year. Yeah. And that means rents are very high as well. So everybody's impacted.
Yeah. You raise the issue there in terms of like the homelessness and the temporary accommodation issues. Now that we're in a grip of a pandemic, there's a real spotlight on these challenges, particularly, again, in those kind of communal establishments. What do you see, I suppose, as the main issues there, or the main kind of demographics there?
Well, I think actually Mike Ryan in the WHO said it very well earlier in the week. He said that, you know, for anyone to be safe, everyone has to be safe, you know, and that we're only really as good as the weakest link in our communities. And when we have people in unsafe and unsanitary conditions, it impacts on everybody else. So it's not just a social justice issue, it's a public health issue. And we have been putting people and huge numbers in really unsuitable accommodation, And it's very easy to quantify, you know, how little bed space, how many people are sharing bedrooms in hotels, how poor their quality of food is, how it's impacting on their children's development and education. You know, some of those things are quantifiable, but the other side is the mental health impact, the lack of opportunity in the future for people, you know, when they start out like that, the limitations that will put on those children in their future lives. And also we're seeing now the huge risk of disease spread in those kind of settings, where people are, you know, whole families sleeping in one room, a bed that has a different person sleeping in it every night of the week in a hostel. People in direct provision, where there could be 8 or 10 people who are strangers sleeping in a small space, lots of people sharing toilets, kitchens being prepared by somebody else, food being prepared by somebody else. And, you know, when you start to look at all of the advice now about making all of us safe in public health, you see the enormous risk we have just built into the system. Primarily to the people who are living there, but in a wider way to the people who are working there, to everybody else in the community and to the health services. Because if we have, and it looks like about 17,000 people in shared unsuitable accommodation between homelessness and direct provision, 17,000 people is a quantifiable risk of what the impact of infection in those settings could be on our health services. And that impacts on everybody. So I think it's really critically urgent at the moment that people be rehoused in settings where they have a private bathroom and a place to prepare food and enough space that a family can put somebody in a separate bedroom and care for them if they're ill, that they're not sharing bedrooms with siblings or parents in that situation. And there may be only, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 households that need to be accommodated. And that is very easily done. I think at the moment our tourist industry is completely dead for the time being. There are any number of holiday villages, Airbnbs, and other kind of more apartment style student housing and holiday lets. 4,000 or 5,000 units in that is not a lot when you say the size of our tourist and student accommodation sector. It would be very easy to house the number of people, that 17,000 people, very quickly, to my mind. And it should be seen as a public health emergency that people are put into safe settings.
Yeah, I mean, we had a look at these figures during the week. And when you include traveller shared accommodation, which tends to be a euphemism for overcrowding, and you include the numbers on the social housing waiting lists that have gone up in terms of overcrowding, you're potentially looking at about 14,700 households, and that would include kind of single people, couples.
Yeah. As well. And there are people in domestic violence shelters who are in shared settings as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, we're grossly underprovided for in terms of that. You know, we should have over 400. I think we've got 141 spaces in domestic violence centres. So obviously, you know, outside of the current issue and the immediate danger for those households, we've also got, you know, 9,000 individual women potentially in situations where they are social distancing in homes where they are not safe and their children are not safe. The other thing that occurred to me, though, in looking at this, aside from the very vulnerable people that we've talked about there, the notion of co-living, I mean, that has to be reconceptualized now, given where we are. I mean, that was something that was being, you know, promoted as a new way of living before this happened.
It was being promoted because it was profitable, not because there was any desire for it. You know, I have always said that there's probably a niche market for it for certain people who might be migrating to work on a building site in Dublin 4 nights a week, or might be coming from Milan for 3 months or something else. So there will always be a niche market for something like that. That's almost like student living for people who want to socialise with it for limited time periods. But it was never going to be a mass solution for anybody. I mean, where do people who live like that spend Christmas? You know, where do they meet their friends? Where do they form relationships and set up home? You know, and hugely costly and tiny spaces. But I think the last few weeks has thrown the spotlight on the health aspects of it too, because if you have 200 people sharing a lift, how do you manage social distancing? And if you have 40 people sharing a kitchen, and on top of that, you have a centralized ventilation system for the building, whereby, you know, people are breathing the same air at night, and each room may not be independently ventilated now because of air tightness rules with our energy standards. You've also got an issue with cooking facilities in these rooms, when it's already proven that the air quality from cooking is it needs a huge, much higher level of ventilation than a bedroom would. And then when you start to look at how virus, you know, the science of how viruses survive on surfaces, and you see that hard surfaces like plastic and metal can have a virus for several days, and that sunlight and, you know, good ventilation and all these things start to matter in terms of health, you realise that all of our previous legislation around overcrowding was to do with health and was to do with ventilation. So the overcrowding rules we had in the past probably came out of things like TB, rather than out of things like a desire to for every child to have a separate bedroom. You know, the logic has been there right through history in terms of building standards, and it was always about you know, things like ventilation and space, so that disease didn't spread. Because when you set up environments where disease can spread, it impacts on everybody.
Absolutely. Another aspect of this issue, and it was something that you touched on briefly there when you talked about kind of the skills deficits and the capacity pre this crisis in terms of where we need to be for building affordable homes. Something like 46% of the construction sector disappeared essentially around 2008, and the years around that. The debate that's going on at the moment in terms of construction sites and, you know, whether they should continue to work in terms of essential bills or they should be stopped in terms of protection of the workers. What are your views around that?
I think we need to close non-essential sites, basically. I think people are being put in danger, and it's happening for financial reasons. Now, we have already, as a society, we have already accepted that people's health has to come first before money in this situation. The pubs had to close, the schools had to close, businesses have had to close. Everybody, every sector is feeling enormous pain. The reason the construction sector is still open is for financial reasons, not for health reasons. And I have huge sympathy. I mean, it is the sector that suffered worst in the recession. It is the sector that has been probably slowest to recover. There's enormous financial pressure on people because nearly everybody is self, or a huge proportion are self-employed. And if they don't work until Friday, they don't get paid this week. And people are under enormous pressure and knowingly having to go into unsafe situations. So I think it's wrong that the construction sites are still open. I think it's putting huge pressure on people. And I think the money has to be found to pay people to stay at home in the same way it has in the pubs and restaurants and tourist sector and the teachers and everybody else. Obviously, essential work would have to continue. The HSE are undertaking emergency works to try and get testing centres and hospital beds up and running. There are other essential works, obviously, if there's an electrical or a gas safety problem that has to be dealt with. You know, there are things that, you know, water supply has to be secure, our broadband has to be kept running, our energy supply. And there are other essential works which could be defined in the same way that in the retail sector, you know, the food supply has been secured, but shopping for clothes isn't essential, but shopping for food is. I think we need to take the same view in the construction sector. And I think a lot of the delay on some of this has been around money and contract disputes. It would be much better to have a clean break, I think, and a structured shutdown. If we continue with sites, what will happen is people will start to get ill and materials will start to become in short supply because supply chains are impacted. Particularly supply chains from China and Europe, you know, materials are not going to be arriving. So rather than have it all fall apart in an unstructured way, which is just going to cause no end of legal disputes and contractual disputes for years, which will actually fall on the construction sector as a real cost, I think a structured shutdown of the non-essential sites would be much better. with the owners or the people who commission the work picking up the tab for site security and insurance during the shutdown and remobilization costs, and with the workers being paid as everybody else is to stay at home for a number of months. Likely, then we will protect our workers, that they will keep their health. We'll protect their families, that they're going home to in the evenings. And we won't get into that years and years of disputes and SME contractors failing over the level of dispute and waiting. You know, disputes mean you're waiting for money. You're not getting paid for something if there's a dispute, and nobody can afford that. I mean, that is a totally unnecessary burden to put on the whole sector.
Absolutely. And I know you've been relatively vocal in the last couple of days in relation to the protective equipment that is used on sites and how that could be redeployed for frontline medical staff, for example. Mm-hmm. If those measures that you talk about in terms of protecting the safety of construction workers were actually implemented, is there much protective equipment on sites? I genuinely wouldn't know.
Well, it depends on what trades are using. But I mean, the health and safety culture in our sites has improved enormously in the last 20 years. PPE is kind of standard now. People would be used to seeing hard hats and high-vis jackets and steel cap boots and things. But on top of that, in any kind of dusty environment or with painting or, any of those, people would be wearing masks. And that would cover a fair number of trades. People would be putting on shoe protectors. They'd be wearing gloves for some tasks. So there is a level of equipment there. And then there's also goggles and eye protection. Now, where I was coming from on that was the health services are telling us there's a problem. It's not the fault of anybody in management in the health services. The entire world started to look for PPE at the same time. Everybody is out trying to procure it and at volume, huge volume that they wouldn't normally. It's like any crisis, I suppose. You look around for what you have to hand and how you might repurpose it. I'd rather see boxes of construction goggles sitting in a storeroom in a hospital than sitting locked up on a site if the site is closed down. And I saw somebody mention earlier today even about school science labs. A lot of them have a box of that might be sitting there since the school was closed. And then you've got the beauticians who all have masks, and the hairdressers, and people in pharma, and even in people in the food sector. Maybe obviously we don't want to contaminate the food supply, but they might be more flexible about using more hand washing or kitchen standard gloves and hand over the latex gloves or the higher protection. And similarly with some of the clean room factories and things, they all have coveralls and protection. So regardless of what supply chain is being put in place by the HSE and all the effort they're putting in, everybody else could actually row in and hand this stuff over in some way, so that if it came to it in a hospital, people can put on coveralls and people can put on gloves and maybe a different standard of eye goggles, but at least they would have some level of protection. And if they're not needed, well and good, but it would be very reassuring to think that they were to hand if they were needed.
Absolutely. And just one final thing, I suppose, when this crisis passes, and of course it will, we'll be in a very different space. We'll be dealing with a very different society, I believe, but also, a different economic reality from what we had maybe a couple of months ago. In terms of housing generally, and the discussion, that we've started to come across in the last couple of days around the need for belt tightening once this is done, what challenges will we face then? What solutions do you think that we can come up with?
I always felt the problem in the last few years was misdefined as a supply problem and that supply would solve the problem. I think everything we have assumed to date needs to be set aside now, and we need to sit down with a blank sheet of paper. The projections for the housing demand are obviously completely off. They were all based on a 3% growth rate and population and inward migration projections and whatever else based on that. I mean, that's obviously completely gone. We have no idea what way the economy is going in the next year, never mind the next 10 years. So we need to, I think, step away from those longer term projections and those talks of, you know, 10,000 and 50,000 and 35,000 a year and whatever else. All of that is based on flawed projections now. I think we need to acknowledge that whatever demand is, market is a different thing. And if we're relying on market rate housing, you might have demand for 10 or 15,000 houses a year, but there isn't a market for them at the prices they had. And we are very likely now entering recession and high unemployment, certainly in the short term, to see prices come down significantly. It looks like there's a lot of tourist lets coming back on the market in Dublin and probably the other cities. So we will have plenty probably in the short term of rental accommodation, which will bring prices down, which means the supply pipeline for the build to rent is probably gone because the projections of income they were looking for will not be there. The new build sector, similarly, if prices in the market generally drop, well, all the projections that their business plans are have to be rewritten, and probably means those sites will stall. I don't think anybody's going to be paying 400,000 for a house in Dublin suburbs for a while. And then we will still have an issue with labour and materials. Our supply chains on materials will have to be rewritten. The same level of transportation isn't happening. The same level of migration and easy migration won't be happening for a while. So I think we'll have to look very hard at what we actually need, what we've actually got. So in some ways, the drop in the tourist side and probably in international students has freed up quite a bit of space in the short term to give some breathing space while we reassess the need on new builds. And maybe all of this will really focus attention on how far our standards have been allowed to fall on new build in the last number of years. We went, if you even look at Dublin, we went within the space of about 4 years from a situation where a new build social housing, I would say a two bedroom was a certain size, had storage space, and had a certain number of families sharing one lift, you know, a maximum number sharing a lift. And they had a balcony, to a situation whereby the unit was considerably smaller, where you had an unlimited number of people sharing a lift, which again is now seen as a health risk, and where people had no balcony and no space. Now, when you see how we're all managing at the moment with children off school and people working from home, you can see that space in houses is really, really important, and balcony space is important, and sharing lifts and stairs with a limited number of neighbours and controlling infection spread, you know, by breaking up blocks is really important as well. And the one that you know, we've been hearing about for years unchallenged is we don't need dual ventilation, dual aspect apartments. Dublin City Council had a requirement for dual aspect apartments for a very good reason. You get cross ventilation. So it's not a luxury. It's to do with health as well. So I hope that the first thing we do is we step back from all of this talk about single aspect apartments, huge numbers of people sharing the same lifts and stairs, small rooms, minimal sizes, lack of balconies, and all of those things that we now realise are really, really important in housing stock, and building tiny spaces for rental, with building in all of that risk for another virus outbreak or a future health challenge, is really short-termism. I mean, there's no saving in building things that way. It's entirely to do with a higher profit margin in the short term, but the cost is borne by everybody else. You know, the cost is borne by the people who have to live there, and by everybody in the future who has, you know, as a country, if we have a stock of substandard housing, we're stuck with it for the next 50 or 60 years.
We certainly are. So thank you so much, Orla. I really do appreciate your time. It's been really informative. And I hope our listeners have taken as much out of it as certainly I have today. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Colette. It's nice to speak to somebody outside the house.
Likewise.
Following this interview, which took place on Friday, the 27th of March, the government announced a closure of all non-essential sites. Dublin City Council has announced new living spaces to transfer people from communal homelessness accommodation. These are important and welcome measures, but more is needed. When this crisis passes, and it will pass, we will need to rethink how we want to live as a society. Housing policy will be a necessary part of that discussion. Until then, the immediate protection of the most vulnerable must be a priority. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast. Until next time, stay safe.